Now is case number 84607, Limpresert versus Pam Specialty Hospital. I just want to note that Justice Bell, due to circumstances beyond her control, is unable to be here in person today, but she is participating by Zoom and will participate in the decision in this case. So with that, is everybody ready to proceed? Okay. Well, do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Reserve 5 minutes.
Okay. So you get 15 minutes per side. When it gets down to 5 minutes, the yellow light will come on. There'll be a tone to remind you, but the clock keeps running down to zero if you're still standing there. With that, go ahead, please.
Good morning to all. There are obviously two prongs.
Sorry. Can you introduce yourself, please?
Indeed. Jared Anderson.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you. There are obviously two prongs to this appeal. The first prong of the argument is that this case can be brought under principles of ordinary or general negligence. It doesn't have to be brought as a professional negligence case. And obviously I'll get into that in a little more detail in just a moment. The second prong of the argument is, of course, even if treated as a professional negligence case, the requirements under NRS 41A.071 have been satisfied. So starting with the first argument, which I'll refer to as the Szymborski argument, what we understand very clearly, what's clearly laid out in the law is that the burden is on the defendant to show that a case falls under the medical malpractice statute. And that's Yafchak versus Southern Las Vegas Medical. And I think the Court of Appeals in the decision reversing and remanding said it very well when they identified the issue for the Szymborski argument as if the jury can only understand the plaintiff's allegations with the assistance of expert testimony, then it is a professional negligence case. However, if it can be understood without the need for expert testimony, then it can sound under principles of ordinary or common negligence. Now, I say that in that particular way for a reason, and that is because there are cases in which, many cases in which the allegations giving rise to a lawsuit can be viewed either way. It could be medical malpractice, or it could also be viewed as general or ordinary negligence. It fits both criteria. And what the Court of Appeals, again, the Court of Appeals, I think, said it very well in the decision, reversing and remanding, and this is on page 6 of the decision. Thus, because there are some facts that could entitle Limpresert to relief under ordinary negligence, such as the staff let him go, we reverse the district court's order and remand for further proceedings.
But aren't you kind of expanding Szymborski? I mean, in Szymborski, the allegation was that the hospital told the father of the patient that they would tell the father when the patient was released because of a violent relationship between the two. Mm-hmm. Then the hospital not only didn't tell the father, but they put the guy in a cab or took him to the father's house and dropped him off, and he trashed the house. And so that fell outside the realm of, there was no doctor-patient relationship between the father and the hospital, and so it was kind of clearly ordinary negligence. I'm a little concerned about 41A100, which lists res ipsa exceptions, and they're very specific. One is like operating on the wrong patient, where you don't need an expert affidavit. Two is leaving sponges in the patient. You didn't count them when you took them out. And there's three others. Should that be the exclusive instances where it's the medical relationship between the patient and the facility? Should the ones listed in 100 be the exclusive ones that we recognize?
Thank you very much for the question.
And I apologize for it late.
Oh, no, no, no. No, I think it's, no, I appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. My first response would be that the facts, the underlying facts in Szymborski are obviously quite different from what we have in this case. That's certainly clear. However, the rule that was set forth in Szymborski, I think, applies very well to this case. And what this court said in Szymborski that I think is important here is that there are going to be situations where even situations where a case could be either or, could be medical malpractice, could fit that criteria, but could also fit the criteria for general or ordinary negligence. And what what this court said in Szymborski was, in those situations, the plaintiff decides how he wants to bring his case. If it can fit under principles of ordinary negligence, then he should be allowed to bring it under those principles. And the deciding factor or the criteria for knowing when that exists is when a layperson, an ordinary member of a jury, would be able to easily understand the factual issues of negligence without the need for expert testimony. That is a case that can be brought under principles of ordinary negligence. And I think that's that was the rule in Szymborski that applies to this case.
Doesn't that open a wide gate to the affidavit of merit requirement in our statute?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason why I don't think so is because it's clearly a fact-specific inquiry. And in every case where the court determines that a jury would really need expert testimony to understand an issue, that falls under the affidavit requirement. However, if the court determines, no, this is something that can be easily understood by a jury, it just falls outside of the need for that affidavit. So I think that's my answer. Would you like any further to elaborate further on that?
No, the only question I have is your colleagues on the other side say, well, this was during COVID and the patient was COVID compromised, and would there be a need for expert testimony with respect to how do you deal getting people out of bed and their sheets changed in a facility where you have the risk of COVID? And I don't remember if this patient had COVID or not. I don't recall, but okay. Those protocols would require expert testimony in their estimation.
Yeah. Let me answer that. I'm going to grab some water before I do so.
Okay.
Mr. Anderson, while you're almost answering that question, I missed when we started that you didn't file a reply brief in this case, which means you actually don't get an opportunity for rebuttal, so you use your entire time now.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. So to answer your question, this patient came into the hospital after he had had COVID. I haven't thought of the question of whether he could possibly still be contagious or not. I believe enough time had passed that he didn't have COVID anymore. He was simply suffering from adverse side effects from COVID. And I apologize. I simply hadn't thought of that issue. But my understanding is that the interaction in this case had anything to do with COVID. It was simply that he was so weak and debilitated, he lacked the strength to stand by himself. Does that answer the court's question?
Yeah, thank you so
Mr.
much.
Mr. Anderson, if I could jump in then.
Please.
Unlike pushing a bed into a wall or something like that, that's going to hurt anybody who that happens to.
Sure.
The fact that this particular patient was at risk for a fall, isn't that based on the medical information they have in the course of treating him and the extent to which he requires assistance is then a medical evaluation that would warrant expert testimony about whether this is someone who just needs help getting up or whether someone who needs to continue to be supported.
Thank you very much for that question. I think that the best way to answer that question would be to provide maybe a couple of real world examples of similar situations that don't involve medical treatment whatsoever. For example, let's say there's a security officer on the strip and there's someone who has fallen, encounters that person. It's clear that they lack the strength to stand. The security officer raises them to their feet, having reasonable cause to believe they don't have the strength to stand, and then releases them and they fall. That would be a case that could be brought under principles of ordinary or general negligence. And I think that is analogous to what we have in this case. Another example would be an aide at, for example, an assisted living home, assisting someone who is elderly to get out of bed, someone who lacks the ability to stand on their own. And then knowing or having reasonable cause to believe they lack the ability to stand on their own, releasing them, they fall to the ground, they suffer injury. There's an ordinary negligence case there. And I think those facts are so similar to, I think they're analogous to the facts we have in this case. Of course, there are additional things that will be fleshed out in discovery. We haven't obviously gotten to that point. But the allegations in the complaint, the facts in the record, are simply that we have a debilitated patient who lacks the strength to stand. The allegation is that the nurses assisting him out of bed to change the sheets had either knowledge that he lacked the strength to stand or reasonable cause to believe he lacked the strength to stand. And regardless, they let go of him. He fell. He suffered injury. And so for that reason, it simply falls outside of the sphere of the medical malpractice statute, because any reasonable jury looking at those facts would be able to make that determination as to whether there was negligence involved without the need for expert testimony.
So was there a medical protocol in place at the time that directed the hospital staff on how to assist the patient in getting from the bed to the floor, and those protocols were simply just not followed?
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that because we have not proceeded into discovery yet.
Mr. Anderson?
Yes.
If the court were to conclude that it sounded in malpractice, okay, can you talk to us about the affidavit?
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Your Honor. That's obviously the second prong of the appeal. And as the Court of Appeals concluded, the Court of Appeals based its reasoning on the Baxter case that this court issued. And I think the most important thing that the Baxter decision tells us is when we look at the statute, NRS 41A.071, there's no requirement that a supporting affidavit or declaration be physically attached to a complaint. There's nothing in the statute that says you need to do that. It says you have to have one. And the reason I think that language is very important is when we look at the public policy behind the enactment of that statute, it's very clearly directed toward preventing frivolous lawsuits from being filed. So before a lawsuit, there's a requirement. You have to consult with a doctor. And so in this case, in an abundance of caution, we pled this case in the alternative. We just wanted to have all our bases covered. So we did consult with a medical professional about this issue, just in case someone else's interpretation differed from ours. And so we obtained a supporting declaration from Dr. Curtis, supporting the allegations in this case. And we referenced that in our complaint, paragraph 33. We incorporated it within that complaint. We intended to attach it. I mean, I think We said that pretty clearly in our briefing. It was a mistake that it was not attached as Exhibit 1 to the complaint. So we missed that. But we had it, and we had it before we filed the complaint.
But unlike Baxter, the declaration was ultimately submitted beyond the statute of limitations date.
True. Right?
So is that something that should factor into our consideration?
That's a great question. I don't think so, because there's nothing in Baxter where this court said that's a requirement, that there be one. This court said, first, there's no requirement that the affidavit or supporting declaration be attached at all, like at any time. It did say in dicta, it would be better practice to have attached it to the original complaint, and I would agree with that, and that's what we intended to do. But the court never said that there was a requirement at all, and they certainly did not impose some sort of a time restriction or a particular procedural mechanism by which the affidavit has to be filed by such and such a date, if it has to be filed at all. So I think that the respondent's argument about that, am I out of time?
You are indeed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Keith Weber. I am here today with my colleague, Alyssa Bestick. Pan respectfully asserts that for at least five primary reasons, the Court of Appeals order of reversal and remand was incorrect. Pan requests that this court reverse the Court of Appeals determination and uphold the order of district court dismissing this case.
So, counsel, I'm going to cut you off, we've gone through this a little bit. When we grant a petition for review, there is no more Court of Appeals opinion. So or order, opinion, whatever. So if we can focus, doesn't mess you up too much, if we can focus on what the district court did and why the district court should be affirmed or reversed, it'd just be helpful for our analysis. They're not an intermediate court, so we don't reverse them or uphold them in that way.
Thank you. So first on that point, Justice Stiglitz, the district court was correct in its ruling because the complaint filed by Mr. Limpersert against Pam, that counsel says allegedly purported to be for ordinary negligence and alternatively for professional negligence, is just not correct. The entirety of the complaint is one for professional negligence, and one only needs to look at the very first substantive paragraph in the cause of action for negligence, which I admit it's simply called negligence, not ordinary negligence, nor professional negligence. If one looks at the very first paragraph in the cause of action for negligence, it says, during the course of care provided to plaintiff, defendant had a duty to exercise that degree of care, diligence, and skill ordinarily exercised by hospital nurses and caregivers in good standing in the community. That's right out of the box, right after it incorporates by reference all of the general allegations that are just simply repeated in the cause of action. It starts out talking about the standard of care of the PAM defendants. The next paragraph after that, paragraph 42, gets into even more detail with the factual allegations of specifics relating to during the course of care, a plaintiff defendant failed to exercise that degree of care, diligence, and skill ordinarily exercised by hospitals, nurses, and caregivers, among other things, and this is key, failing to properly administer care, failing to properly monitor, which is a big deal, as we know after this court's ruling in the state of Curtis, that by definition is professional negligence, failing to properly oversee the care, failing to monitor the plaintiff, which all of the
appellate... Counsel, we're talking about a patient being moved out of the bed and falling. I mean, it seems to me that the average layperson jury should be able to understand without the assistance of a medical expert, that if you're going to move a patient from from the bed to a standing position who is weak and who's unable to stand on his or her own, that that would require some just, you know, ordinary care, and you got to make sure they're propped up. Why is that outside of the realm of understanding for the average layperson jury?
Thank you, Justice. The reason, Justice Lee, that it is outside of the common knowledge exception and requires expert opinion is the exact reasons the plaintiff's expert says in his affidavit attached to the complaint. Keep in mind that when Dr. Curtis attached the affidavit to the complaint, his very opening paragraph is that I'm qualified to talk to whether there was breach of the standard of care of the fall on August 3rd because of my education, training, and background. So he led with the reason he could talk about whether the nurses were negligent is because he was an expert witness. And then in every single paragraph underneath that, he talked about how this is known, what to do and what not to do in the medical community. Those are his words. He didn't say...
Are those mutually exclusive concepts? Can't he opine on those procedures and protocols based on his expertise, I guess? But I guess I go back to my original question. If they chose not to do that and they didn't attach that medical affidavit, albeit after the statute of limitations, wouldn't an ordinary jury still be able to understand the concept of having to support someone in a weakened state to stand up? I mean,
No, for this reason. It's not common knowledge of the jurors, I don't think, that because you assist someone to stand up, if you let go of them, they're going to fall. I mean, if that were the case, every Sunday in church when I help someone to their feet to take communion, I need to assume they're going to fall. There may be particularized circumstances specific to a patient why that would be the case, and that was the case here, as Dr. Curtis alleged, but that's specific to the patient based on the patient's physical condition, their mental condition, their status, what they could do, what they couldn't do. So the minute it gets into the issue of whether or not the determination needs to be, was the negligent conduct because these two nurses let the patient go after getting the rise to speak, medical judgments come into play as to whether or not they should have used medical judgment, as Dr. Curtis says, to help them sit back down, to not let go of them, to put them into a chair. Those are all medical judgments. And as soon as you get into those medical judgments as to whether the nurses should have known it was foreseeable if they let go of him, he was going to fall, expert testimony is required. And that's really what the crux of the issue is even by Dr. Curtis's standard, the nurses, because they practice in the community, and his words, in the medical community, they should have taken into account his weakened status, his respiratory issues, the fact that he was on COVID. And by the way, this was medical treatment. There is no allegation in the complaint that the nurses were assisting him to stand, to change the sheets. That's nowhere alleged in the complaint. Any more is it that it's alleged in the complaint that there were fall precautions orders. That's just simply nowhere in any allegation in the complaint.
So going to the second prong then, if we say that this is not ordinary negligence, how does Baxter not give the plaintiff a kind of a safe harbor in terms of when they produce the procured affidavit? Because it looks like the affidavit was actually procured on the same day the complaint was filed, probably inadvertently not attached. What was the prejudice to your client because that was not served for maybe, I think, about a month later?
So, Justice Lee, the prejudice to my client is that it wasn't filed and served. Plaintiff's counsel or appellant's counsel just advised you that there's nothing that says that the affidavit ever needs to be attached to the complaint. That may be true in what Baxter said, but what Baxter said is it still needs to be filed and served, and it needs to be filed and served so that the defendant has an opportunity to respond to it. We filed our motion to dismiss before we were ever provided, and it was never served. We just got it because it was filed with the court. We just got it because After we filed the motion to dismiss, it was then filed with the court. Now, to be honest, the prejudice was that we simply didn't have an opportunity to respond to it, number one. Number two, it was past the statute of limitations, which is a big deal. And quite frankly, the Baxter is not a safe harbor for Mr. Limpresser in this case, because even though it was eventually filed and served, unlike in Baxter, where you said, or the court said effectively, it was a no harm, no foul, in Baxter it was 5 hours later. Here it was 5 weeks later, after we filed a motion to dismiss and after the statute of limitations had run. So with all due respect, that's just not a no harm.
So the affidavit was referenced in the complaint, right?
Yes.
And you got the complaint, right?
Yes.
And then you waited how long to file the motion to dismiss?
The appropriate time within which to respond. I don't know exactly how it was within the time to respond. I don't know the exact time.
Well, on the prejudice issue, though, I mean, assuming the complaint is filed and the affidavit is included with the complaint, or it's filed 5 hours later, let's say, the prejudice to you really would be not being able to challenge maybe the doctor's qualifications to have issued the expert affidavit. So how was that precluded by the fact that it was filed 5 weeks later?
It wasn't.
Okay.
So let me be very direct about this. And what I'm going to say is a little bit controversial in the defense community, believe me. And hopefully Mr. Carvalho won't tell it to my colleagues. I will surrender on many of these affidavit issues if the trend stops going toward the fact that expert testimony isn't needed in an expert affidavit, or there doesn't need to be an affidavit, and therefore it is ordinary negligence. Because what the court has taken the extra step in saying that if there doesn't need to be expert testimony, and therefore there doesn't need to be an expert affidavit or for all parts, and that therefore it's ordinary negligence, after Curtis is opening the floodgates, it is rare for me to now get a run-of-the-mill medical malpractice complaint that doesn't have allegation after allegation of ordinary negligence. And the reason is clear, because the stakes are very high. If it's ordinary negligence, then the non-economic cap doesn't apply. Several liability doesn't apply. The introduction of collateral sources doesn't apply. So after Curtis, and because there is now this perception that ordinary negligence can be pled if an allegation can be made that expert testimony isn't necessary, all medical malpractice, largely all medical malpractice cases are being pled with allegations of ordinary negligence. And it's creating, and will create for this court, a quagmire, because the district courts are now having to decide allegation by allegation by allegation. Is it professional negligence or ordinary negligence? And it's getting to be a quagmire. So one way that that can be pulled back is, regardless of what's going to happen with the affidavit issue, is that if the next step of if expert testimony isn't necessary for purposes of the affidavit, or timeliness of the affidavit, if it can be pulled back or redirected, that simply not needing expert testimony doesn't mean it's ordinary negligence. And with all due respect, I think a way that that can be accomplished is simply following the Nevada statute that defines what professional negligence is. And professional negligence in NRS 41A.015 basically says that if the services, or if the negligent act occurs during the rendering of services, that's professional negligence. That's the way the law has been for 50 years in California, and they don't have to get into this hair splitting, because if the negligent act arises out of the provision of medical services, or the rendition of services is how our statute reads, it's professional negligence. And then we don't have to get into these issues, including what the district court did here, and looking allegation by allegation by allegation. Is expert testimony required or not? Because whether it's required or not it's still professional negligence. And to your point, Justice Pickering, just like in NRS 41A 100, where there are five examples of when expert testimony isn't necessary, but it's still medical malpractice, the same can hold true for all of these cases. There's still professional liability, whether every allegation within the claim requires expert testimony or not. And I think the court, this court in Curtis, affirmatively alluded to that potential when it favorably cited the California case of Bellamy, where in Bellamy, a patient fell off an unsecured x-ray table that was on a slant. And everybody in that case, in the underlying case, said you don't need expert testimony to know the patient should be secured, the brake should be on the x-ray table, and it shouldn't be on a decline. But the court in that case said, regardless of whether expert testimony is necessary, the negligent act occurred during the provision of medical services, therefore it's professional negligence. And again, that's a case that you cited or the court cited favorably in Curtis, is that when allegations are intertwined, inextricably intertwined, or overlapping, which is pretty much every professional negligence case, if it arises out of the provision of services, the rendition of services, as the statute says, and NRS 41A.015 defined professional negligence, then it's professional negligence. And then the district courts, thank you.
Thank you,
Council.
Questions?
I did have a question, if I could.
Go ahead, Justice.
You mentioned, Mr. Weaver, a couple of things that you said were not in the record. One being that the gentleman was being assisted so that the sheets could be changed, and the other being that there was a doctor's orders about assistance with him when standing or walking. So what is in the record in your mind that speaks to why he was being taken out of bed and assisted by the nurses?
I don't know. If I have to accept as true plaintiff's factual allegations, first of all, there is no allegation that the sheets were being changed. That is in the affidavit of the expert. But keep in mind, in violation of Baxter, the expert's affidavit doesn't incorporate the complaint. The complaint incorporates the expert's affidavit, but the expert, Dr. Curtis, doesn't even say he read the complaint or knew it. So that's not part of the complaint, so far as I can tell, because it's not an allegation. With regard to the doctor's order, there is an allegation that the nursing staff failed to follow the doctor's orders, which under Curtis is classic failure to monitor by definition. What was alleged below was that the nursing staff or the PAM staff in general failed to follow the fall precautions order. But there is no allegation anywhere in the complaint that there were fall precautions put in place.
I have one quick question, and the chief.
Yes, Justice Pickering.
Do you concede, as your colleagues say, that the affidavit preexisted the filing of the complaint?
I have no reason to dispute that. It is dated the day of the complaint. So I've worked with Mr. Anderson for years, and I have absolutely no reason to mistrust that.
I thought that
appreciate
that. Was
that.
Consensus. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. So this matter will stand submitted, and we'll get you a decision as soon as we are able.